Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., and there are many more podcasts for this and all our other faith radio shows available on our website. You can just go to myfaithradio.com. And thanks so much for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Welcome. So nice to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio Network. Today, we journey back in time to the Roman Empire to learn more about the context in which the New Testament was written. And you're going to find this to be a fascinating journey with a professor of history from Wheaton College who has written this really cool new book called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. You know, we know a little bit about, I think most of us know a little bit about Roman centurions from probably some of the movies we've seen. But how does diving into this life of a Roman centurion help us to understand what we read every day when we have our daily devotions and read from the New Testament? Well, our guest, Dr. Gary Burge, will help us with that here in just a few minutes, so stick around. First, though, if you're a mom or dad, have you talked to your kids about the dangers of synthetic marijuana? If not, it is way past time to have that conversation, and here's why. Synthetic marijuana is becoming the new drug of choice for many young people in America, and I'm very concerned. I got to tell you, poison control centers in the United States are being flooded with calls about synthetic marijuana this year. In fact, so far, just in the first 6 months of the year, 4,000 calls have come in across the country to these poison control centers. That is a 200% increase over last year. And what's even more disturbing is there have been at least 15 deaths related to synthetic pot just in the first 6 months of the year. You know, I've talked about this before. It's not necessarily a new problem, but obviously there has been this just huge increase in the amount of this lab-created imitation pot that's on the streets, and that's despite the efforts of local law enforcement to crack down on this. Now, if you don't know this, and again, if you're a mother or father, especially with a preteen or a teenager at home, synthetic marijuana is sold under brand names like Spice and K2. It's typically made from a mixture of dried herbs sprayed with psychoactive chemicals. And the Centers for Disease Control is weighing in on this spike in the problems with this. Dr. Royal Law says, even though these products are often marketed as natural and safe, they are not. Now, most of these calls to poison control centers related to fake pot are reporting things like vomiting, dizziness, shortness of breath, confusion, rapid heartbeat, and there's just been some tragic stories of kids who are now in a hospital, in a coma, brain dead, because of their very first experience with this stuff. Synthetic pot is technically illegal all across the country, but what the makers do, these evil people that make this stuff and sell this stuff, they are continually tweaking their ingredients and mislabeling them, and sometimes they even sell it as incense. And by doing that, they are able to basically evade the efforts of law enforcement agencies. I can't tell you how concerned I am, because I keep reading these stories day after day and seeing these photographs of these young people in hospital beds being incubated, on life support, no brain activity, their mom and dad sitting by their bedside, hoping and praying that somehow that they will recover. Anyway, if you really need to learn more about this, parents and grandparents and youth pastors, youth leaders, if you're involved in working with youth in any capacity, go to this website. It's the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. It's drugfree.org, drugfree.org, to learn more about this junk. Again, Spice, K2, there are some other names for it. So, man, I'm just very, very troubled. Well, something else, and this is more of a positive story, but it made me kind of laugh. I think all of us that are parents are probably concerned. If we're not, I'm surprised if you're not concerned about this, but you're probably concerned about how much time your kids spend in front of a screen every day. But is it possible that your kids are concerned about you and how much time you are spending on your mobile device? There was a new survey out of 6,000 kids and teenagers, and it found that 54% of children say their parents check their smartphones too often. More than a third of kids said their parents were sometimes distracted by their devices during conversations, and a lot of the kids said those distractions made them feel unimportant. Oh, my goodness. And by the way, a lot of parents seem to realize they have a problem. Half of the parents in this survey confessed to checking their phones too frequently, and many admitted it was probably setting a bad example for their children. The company that did the survey, ABG Technologies, Tony Anscombe is with ABG, and he says, "With our kids picking up mobile devices at increasingly younger ages, it's really important that we set good habits within the home early on. Children take their cues from us for everything else, so it's only natural that they should do the same with device use." Well said, Tony. And by the way, true confessions time. We don't allow tech at the dinner table in our house for a variety of reasons. But the other night, I got up from the table to get an extra fork, and my cell phone was sitting on the counter, and a text had come in. I'd heard the notification beep, and so I was tempted to check the text. So I kind of walked over surreptitiously and picked up the cell phone, and my 10-year-old daughter nailed me for it. "Dad, why are you looking at your smartphone?" So, yes, even I have a problem with it. There is a great book on this topic, and this is something that should be in your library, on your bookshelf. It's called The Digital Invasion, How Technology is Shaping You and Your Relationships. It's by my friend Dr. Arch Hart, who's from Fuller School of Psychology in Southern California, and his daughter, Dr. Sylvia Hart Frade. They were featured on a Focus on the Family broadcast, a two-parter a while back, just looking at how technology is changing us as a culture and changing our brains, because it is. Especially with young people, it appears to be rewiring our brains in significant ways. So again, the title is The Digital Invasion, How Technology is Shaping You and Your Relationships. Well, it's 12 past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer. This is the Faith Radio Network. Coming up next, our guest, Dr. Gary Burge, as we dive into the life of a Roman centurion. Stick with us.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. So great to have you with us today. As things heat up in the upper Midwest over the next couple of days, you're going to want to make sure you stay hydrated. Well, our guest today is Dr. Gary Burge, and he is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the Chicago area. Gary's passion in his teaching and research and writing, and he really wants us to understand how the unique world of the Middle East in antiquity shapes how we read the New Testament today. Some of the books that Gary has either authored or co-authored include Theology Questions Everyone Asks, the Baker Illustrated Bible Commentary, the New Testament in Antiquity, John, the Gospel of Life, and the award-winning Whose Land, Whose Promise? What Christians Are Not Being Told About Israel and the Palestinians? And today he joins us to talk about his new book, A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. Gary, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's great to be with you.
Now, before we dive into your new book, I have to admit, the title of one of your earlier books kind of jumped out at me. Theology Questions Everyone Asks. We're in a day when there's a lot of debate about Christian theology and certainly orthodoxy. What are some of the main questions that people ask these days about theology, and how do you answer them in that book?
Right. Well, let me tell you, Bill, how the book came about. We have a very large theology department at Wheaton College, and we have about 23, 24 full-time faculty teaching theology and biblical studies at Wheaton. It's enormous. So we talk a lot together about what kinds of questions arise in class, and we discover that many of those questions are the same ones we hear in church all of the time. I mean, questions such as, how complete was Jesus' humanity? Was he really tempted, or is that just fictitious? Did Jesus experience the things that we want to experience? Here's a funny one. Students ask me all of the time, was he interested in getting married? yeah, seriously. I mean, if he had a complete humanity, I mean, was he
sure
sexually? Did he have a complete sexual identity? It's really fascinating. Anyway, the problem of evil and suffering, how does that happen? How do I understand that inside of this world? What are the essential things that you need to believe to be a Christian, or what things are negotiable? So what we did is we gathered together about eight people who teach theology. And I'm a New Testament guy, but I also teach a section of theology. So I'm interested in theology, and by that we mean the history of Christian thought and doctrine. And so we all took a chapter. We divided up the entire book among all of us. And so there is a chapter on who is God and how do we understand our God in the Bible as compared to the gods that are promoted around the world, a chapter on the identity of Jesus Christ, the nature of life in this world, how is the world going to end? We call that eschatology. The nature of humanity. People wonder, am I essentially good or am I fundamentally bad? Mm-hmm. Or am I a really perfect person that has a few bad habits? Or am I really broken to the core? Those kinds of questions surface regularly in class, and we believe that these are consequential questions, because to think rightly about these kinds of ideas really helps you to assemble a coherent faith. So it's the book is being used widely by college students. InterVarsity publishes it. But here's the unexpected thing. It has been adopted by many church groups. So a Sunday school class will actually have everyone buy the book, and then they'll do one chapter per week and just discuss what the main ideas are inside of the chapter and what they still need to think through. So it has become a really, really interesting tool for the church.
What an exciting book, Gary, and I'm so glad that you and your colleagues tackled it. I'm curious, you've been teaching for a while now, and we've addressed this issue before on Faith Radio. As new students come into Wheaton, as the new freshmen come in, have you noticed a significant change? How long have you been teaching, Gary?
I've been teaching for about 30 years, 22 at Wheaton.
Okay, so over the past 30 years, and particularly maybe in the last 10,
right,
are you noticing a very significant change in the amount of biblical knowledge and just basic?
Absolutely, Bill.
Okay,
we can quantify that, Bill. In fact, I would say that it's actually, the span is not 10. It's been over the last 20 years. You have to be kind of in Christian higher education for at least 20 years to see what's happened. So a couple of us put together a really interesting test, just to test simple biblical literacy. And we started giving this test about 12 years ago to our incoming freshmen. Wheaton College is a fantastic pool to study the American church because we're large. We have students from every state, I think, in the United States, plus many foreign countries. We're multi-denominational. So you really get a cross-section of the church, the evangelical church at Wheaton. And so we were amazed at how few students could even pass this simple test. that we have some very large evangelical churches in our area, and believe it or not, I had the youth leaders say, oh, our students would never fail that test because our high school kids are amazing with the Bible. So I
I hear this one coming.
So
go ahead.
I gave them the test, and I promised them the results. Same stats all the way through. And here's what we found out. This is all published, by the way, in Christianity Today. You can find it on the web very easily. Just put in my name, and I think it's called The Greatest Story Never Read. And what we found is that students do not have a linear understanding of the Bible. If you ask them who came first, Abraham or Moses, it's a very simple question. It's remarkable that the majority cannot answer the question correctly. Just simply putting, say, a list of names in order, let's try this, Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus, Paul, something like that, and you say, scramble them, and now please put them in order. Or where would you find this event recorded inside of the Bible? Could you go to the Bible and find this? It's amazing. It's really, really amazing. We
and
even doing a fun one. Do you believe in reincarnation?
And what was the what percentage
not,
of kids
positive hits on that one? So
what percentage of young people said they did, Gary? I'm just curious.
Yeah,
what,
there were, I know, even in high schools. It's fascinating. But that's a really small percentage, but you're thinking, how does that even slip into there? It means that in some manner this younger generation has fully and completely assimilated ideas, values from their surroundings. And they really do not have a biblical worldview. And there's been a lot of writing about stop me, Bill, if I go on too long here.
No, this is great stuff, Gary. This is critical. This is
where this is coming from, and we think that contemporary Protestant or evangelical preaching is really needs-based. So what happens is the pastor or the preacher is tempted to say, well, I want to talk about tithing, or I want to talk about depression, or I want to talk about vision. And therefore, you rummage around inside of the Bible, you pull out your favorite text, and then you preach. But very few people actually teach in the sense of teaching the narrative of biblical history. And so what happens is you train a younger generation to have this, what we call it as an affective view of the Bible. I use the Bible as a convenient tool, like opening the refrigerator. If I'm really distressed, I don't want to find where the ice cream is. So I open the Bible to find those passages that comfort me, that stimulate thoughts that I want, and I have my favorite spots, but I really don't know the whole story. And if you ask them, well, could you find the Lord's Supper in the Bible? They might say, well, it's in the Gospels, but it would take me a couple minutes. They couldn't do that. What book is the Pentecost on in? And it's amazing. They very few would know that it's in the book of Acts. This is all hard to believe, I know. Ask them to find the Ten Commandments. That's amazing, really amazing. Of course, we know that, I guess you'd say, that Jesus made that up, and it's in the Sermon on the Mount.
Sure, so, there you go.
You know, it's just astonishing when you have some really fundamental questions like the Ten Commandments. Could you go to the book of Exodus, find the book of Exodus? You know it's Moses. They know roughly. They saw the movie. But finding the text inside of the Old Testament and actually reading it on their own, really tough to do.
So
we've got hard data on this, and I think it changed the way that we teach intro to the Bible, intro to the New Testament, intro to the Old Testament at Wheaton College. We are content-driven now. We want students to inherit the story because that's our story.
Wow, I'm so grateful to hear that. Let me ask you this. It seems like you mentioned, unfortunately, the dearth of good, solid biblical teaching in our churches, which obviously and that's something I think a lot of us are aware of. But there's the other issue. What this says to me is that parents are falling down on the job. Either they don't know their Bible, or they don't access their Bible, or they don't read their Bible, or they don't teach their Bible to their kids. And okay, historically, let's just look back at the history of this country, and we look at the Puritans, for example. And their incredible love for God's word and the fact that that they want every day they were teaching their kids, they were writing scripture on the hearts of their children so that it impacted all aspects of their life. Man, oh man, we're falling down on the job, aren't we?
Well, yeah, and we just know it's not coming from anywhere. So you could turn to the church, you could to the youth leader. It isn't that we don't do biblical teaching. Most of evangelical preaching comes right out of a text. The problem is the text is disconnected from its context.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody might take a parable, but really you don't know, well, what is a parable and why did Jesus teach in parables and what are the full range of the parables? So oftentimes it's a text which is removed from context. The text is then exploited because it actually touches on a theme you want to touch on. So you springboard off of the text and then you run with your theme.
Mm.
And if you think about a lot of the sermons you've heard, that's probably close to what you've got. But hey, you know, you mentioned the Puritans. One of the interesting things is the pioneers actually that came across the United States, two books that they actually carried was the King James Bible frequently. And the second one was Pilgrim's Progress. I just read Pilgrim's Progress all the way through for the second time in my life, actually, this year. And what's fascinating about Pilgrim's Progress is it assumes that you know the Bible thoroughly.
Right.
Because it is filled with allusions to the Bible throughout. If you don't know the Bible, you really miss a lot of the metaphors and ideas and images that are inside of this story.
Mm.
So here you've had a life saturated with the Scriptures, and then for interest and entertainment, I guess, around the fire, you're reading Pilgrim Progress out loud, and somebody says, oh, that sounds like...
Mm.
It becomes an instructional tool to reinforce what you've already known, you've learned inside of your Scripture readings.
Mm.
I think that's fascinating.
It is, and we've unfortunately come a long way in the wrong direction, Gary. And thank the Lord that you and your colleagues are making a difference there at Wheaton. And there are other schools, University of Northwestern certainly is doing that as well, and many other Christian. Biola is a great example of a school that's is committed to biblical literacy.
Well, what we are fighting for and holding on to, and honestly, I'm just really proud of Wheaton for doing this, is that there is so much biblical content. We require every student to take a four-hour class just in Old Testament survey. It's just a survey of the content, and a four-hour class in the survey of the New Testament, and they stand side by side. That's 8 hours of higher ed curriculum.
Mm.
And what's happening is there's enormous pressure to reduce that to a single three-hour class that surveys the whole Bible. You meet three times a week for 50 minutes and 14 weeks, and you're supposed to have it all down. And it's amazing. That doesn't work nearly as well as this more intense, intentional curriculum. And many colleges are doing what we're doing, but you really have to fight for it inside of your faculty and say, look, we need this kind of focused attention.
Mm. Great stuff, Gary. Our guest is Gary Burge. He is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the Chicago area. And in just a moment, we are going to tell you a little bit about this fascinating new book that Gary has written. It's a fictional book, but it's more than fiction because it will teach you about the context in which the New Testament was written and the characters in the New Testament lived. It's called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. And stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network. We also have three copies of the book to give away if you call us with your contact info, and we'll be right back with more with Gary Burge after this.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. Don't know if you've checked out our website lately, but if not, boy, there's some great content there. The website is myfaithradio.com. Fantastic articles that will help you grow in your faith. And, man, the podcasts. Let me just tell you about one I was listening to last night. My friend Dick Whitworth was filling in for Austin Hill this past week, and yesterday he had this fascinating interview with Pastor Jim Harlow. Jim is the pastor of Skyline Church in San Diego, where I used to make my old stomping grounds way back when, in my younger days. But Jim Harlow is a fascinating dude, and he just had some great things to say. You need to check that out. If you go to myfaithradio.com and then look for the Austin Hill in the Morning page and then scroll down and find yesterday's podcast content, the interview with Pastor Hollick. Man, good stuff. Well, my guest this hour is Dr. Gary Burge. Dr. Burge is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the Chicago area. He has a new book out, which is kind of a departure for him because it's a fictional book, but it's more than fiction because it will teach you a lot about the context in which the New Testament was written. The book is called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. And Gary, let's dive into the book. First of all, explain why it's so important to understand historical context when we read the Bible, and why when we interpret, when we read the Bible and don't know the context, we really are reading into it at our own peril, interpreting it at our own peril. So give us a little background on that.
Well, the idea is, and every biblical scholar would sort of work with this every single day, the idea is that every literature, and the Bible is a form of literature, it's a writing, is embedded in its context, in the world it emerged from. So the Bible is going to be written in either Hebrew or Greek, and it's going to be assuming the cultural reflexes of the people who lived 2,000 years ago. If it were not that way, the Bible would have never communicated to its original audience. So every piece of communication really has to target its audience and use the language and framework of the listener. That's the way it always is. So here we are 2,000 years away speaking in English, and we are foreigners to this story. We really are foreigners. We have excellent translations, and that really does help us a great deal. There's a lot of scholarship in the translation. But the thing is that there are things inside of these biblical stories that we cannot understand from this distance. Let me give you one example. When Jesus goes to a village and a woman who's hemorrhaging, who has a long-term problem with blood, comes up to him and touches him and touches the hem of his garment and then is made clean, there are, I would imagine, a dozen layers of cultural foreignness inside of that story. If we don't understand blood, the hem of the garment, what it means to be unclean, her life inside of the village, Jesus' appearance in the village, well, if we don't understand those things culturally, we will begin importing our culture into the biblical story. So, for instance, when someone preaches on the prodigal son, frequently what they'll say is, okay, I wonder what it would be like if my son came to me and said, Father, I would like my inheritance. That can never be the question. The question always has to be, in the first century, what would it be like if a son came to his father and said, Father, I would like my inheritance? So when you represent these ancient stories, you've got to make sure that you represent the ancient context. And for the teacher and preacher, that means you've got to do some more homework before you represent the text.
Well, obviously, you did a lot of homework for this new book, Gary. And if you would, let's kind of walk through the story just a bit. First of all, before we do, let me ask you, this was a bit of a departure for you as professor to write a fictional book. What prompted you to say, you know what, I want to help people understand the context of the New Testament by writing this story about a Roman centurion?
Well, we at university, we have actually conceived of this as a concept. We have about four or five of these books in the pipeline right now. And what we know is that we love stories. Everybody loves great stories. And that if you could create a character who's living in the biblical world, who's using the cultural context constantly inside of this narrative of the story, people will just enjoy reading the story and they will learn things about the context just by following these characters. So it's a fun way to enter into the world of the first century. So in my case, I decided, well, what could be more interesting than following a Roman soldier around the Middle East? We have a story. We always springboard from a story. So I have a story in Matthew 8 about a Roman centurion who's in Capernaum who has a servant who's terribly ill, and Jesus heals his servant. So I thought to myself, well, okay, let's just put that on the shelf. And then let's create a fully orbed character here of a Roman centurion. And it was fun, Bill, actually, just creating a fictional narrative around him. And I wanted my reader to understand that when you see a Roman centurion, don't think American Army. Don't think American Marines. What comes into your mind when you think Roman military officer? You've got to go back in time, and you discover that this guy has a life you never imagined.
Mm. Describe the life of this Roman centurion. Obviously, it's so different from what we experience or understand today, but tell us a little bit about this man and his just daily life.
Well, a Roman centurion... the Emperor Augustus, in the early first century, basically built the largest army the world had ever seen. He had about 28 legions, and there were about 5,000 to 6,000 men inside of a Roman legion. And each legion is broken down into cohorts and centuries, just like we do in American military today. So they had these subdivisions, and that's how they control these things. So a centurion is responsible for roughly 80 guys. Usually it's about 100 or so. He has a life, if he's on the frontier, like this guy, he's out in Judea and Syria. And Judea is Israel today, but Judea is a frontier province. It is scary out there for Romans. Hmm. You've got to be a really tough guy. This is the Fallujah of the ancient world. And their nemesis, their enemies are the Persians. So he is a battle-hardened man. He loves battle, in fact. They live for this. These are career military people. He would be the equivalent of a staff sergeant in the military today.
Hmm.
So what does he like? What is his world filled with? His world is filled with fighting, the testing of your prowess. It is filled with pagan gods because your religious worship tells about your political loyalties to Rome. I put him in a hospital so you can actually see how he is repaired, healed after a battle. He loves beer. He goes to houses of prostitution regularly. All Roman legions were generally surrounded by prostitutes, and he has a concubine. The centurions of that rank could have a concubine that could be with them, though the law said they could not be married. Many of them got married. And he loves blood sport. Romans love blood sport. It represents something about the violence of their world and the aggression that the Romans feel is needed to create peace. So anyway, he goes to blood sport games.
Explain what those are, gladiator games that we're familiar with. That's what you're talking about when you say blood sport.
Yeah, we're talking about gladiator games, but they were called blood sports. So the idea is that there would be traveling shows, and the show would set itself up with a very strong perimeter. Crowds would come. They'd sell tickets. They'd sell like we do. They would sell refreshments and souvenirs. And then what they would do is they would import wild animals. You would have professional soldiers that would be out on the field, and they could vary things. They could have just a knife and a shield. They could have a large sword. They could have bows and arrows. They could have all kinds of things. And they would go up against things like bears, cougars, And what I show is that women were often in these shows. Most people don't know this. There were female gladiators. We know this.
Hmm. Really?
And they wed this idea of, just like we do today in modern cinema, sex and violence.
Hmm.
So that you have a woman dressed as a man provocatively out in the arena, and they would often fight dwarves. And it was an amazing spectacle. It was an incredible spectacle of violence. But the arenas were... I don't know. I mean, some people compare them with just violence for entertainment, and they compare it with like our football stadiums are a toned down sort of experience of that. Men in combat with men for points, and in the arenas, blood sports were life and death affairs, but they were run by professional soldiers. They had heroes, they had stars, they made a great deal of money. So my centurion loves blood sports, and he takes his servant through all of these activities to show him what it means to be a true man.
Amazing.
It's fun. It's very nice. So I had a great time with it, and people find it to be a... But the real goal, though, Bill, is to teach you about Roman culture. so that when you meet a centurion in the Bible, you have a real, honest, true idea of what this guy was like.
Mm. The cover illustration of the book looks like your main character is bowing down with other centurions. What's going on in that particular painting?
You know, it's difficult to know. This is classical art that we've decided to use on all of the books. And this is very likely a worship scene of some kind. So my suspicion would be that they are paying homage to a Roman god. That would probably be what we have here. The centurion that I have, I could have been the Roman legion called Gallica. Gallica was a well-known legion in Syria. And Julius Caesar, they understood to be their patron. When Julius Caesar died, they understood that his soul was elevated, resurrected, was kind of elevated into heaven and became a star in the sky.
Hmm.
And then Julius Caesar looked down on this legion, Gallica, and blessed them. So if they fought well, they would be blessed and prosper. If they fought poorly, they would be dishonored, and many would die.
Hmm.
So they would regularly pay homage to their patron gods. And since Julius Caesar had joined the divinity since he was an emperor, this is likely him then showing that he is subordinate, subservient to his patron, Julius Caesar.
Hmm. Now, did the living emperors, were they considered to be gods, or this was just
right after Julius Caesar was considered to have divine status. And so therefore the coins that are minted, you can see this best on the coins. He is called the divine Julius, the divine Caesar. And when Augustus, or his name was Octavian, but he was given the nickname Augustus, when he comes into power after a tumultuous few years after Julius Caesar dies, he is the adopted son of Julius Caesar, and he is then called the son of the divine Caesar, Julius Caesar. You can see that he's the divine son.
Mm.
And so you have all of this rhetoric among the emperors, which sounds very much like Jesus. So when you have Jesus introduced as the Son of God, Augustus and Tiberius and the emperors that are in that era, they are using this language for themselves because they believe that there is divine status for the emperors.
Is that one of the main reasons why the early church was persecuted? Because there was they would not, promise their allegiance to this god emperor.
It isn't just religion. In the first century, this is a really great example of how cultural context is so different. We have an instinct in our culture that says separate religion and politics.
Mm-hmm.
That's just inherent in the way we think. That did not exist 2,000 years ago. So therefore, when you went to a temple and you, say, gave sacrifice or worship to Apollo or even Augustus, if it was a temple to Augustus, your religious activity was completely intersected with your political loyalties. So when early Christians say, we are not going to worship Caesar, we're not going to do this, they heard it not just as a rejection of religion. They saw it as a faithless citizen of the empire. This is somebody we cannot trust. This is somebody who does not believe in Rome. This is a person who does not believe in the totality of the society that we are creating here. Do you know what I mean?
So it's political rebellion, not just a spiritual act.
It's political, mm-hmm. It's religious. You weave them all together.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do inside of this world. And the Christians, by saying, look, we believe there's another God, you're saying then the Roman Empire is not the ultimate authority in your life?
Mm-hmm.
Caesar does not tell you how you want to live and define the value that you have? And I say, no, I don't. I believe that there's another God. And his son, Jesus, is the one whom I worship. Immediately, you're a dissident.
Mm-hmm.
You are not to be trusted, and you're disloyal. You're disloyal. You're unpatriotic.
When the persecution became really intense, was there a concern on the part of Rome, on the part of the emperor, that this burgeoning movement was a threat to his power?
Only very indirectly. only very indirectly, because the Christian movement, especially in the third century, the real persecution only really gets underway in the late third century, the late 200s. The Christian movement is small. It is really very small. But I think from Rome's point of view, it's the nose of the camel in the tent. So whenever a large empire sees small corners of the empire beginning to fall away, beginning to show disloyalty, they will come down hard on them because they want to teach a lesson to everybody else in the empire.
It's an example. Mm-hmm. Example to the rest of the empire. Mm-hmm.
You know, what's fascinating is that the Romans were very tolerant with Jewish descent. The Jews in the first century were, in the second century, were such a large minority and so respected in many cases that they conceded that they could worship their own God. And the province of Judea was free to do that, so they had their own temple. But inside the province, the Jews, like Herod, built temples to Augustus just to make sure the Romans were happy.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jews had a lot of freedom. But the Christians were understood within 100 years to be not Jews. So, therefore, they had to really subject themselves to Roman authority.
Mm. We're talking to Dr. Gary Berg.
The Roman Centurion book, what I want to do is I want to show the Roman Centurion in all of his toughness and gruffness. I have to explain, how does he get to Capernaum? And then he has encounters with Jewish leaders. And he has to sort out, do I trust these Jewish leaders or don't I? And that's a very important part of the book.
Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and unpack what happened in Capernaum with this central character of your book. Again, the book is called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion, the author, Dr. Gary Berg. We have three copies of the book to give away. If you want to give us a call, give us your contact info. We will put you into a drawing at the end of the hour. We'd love to give you one of these. We'll take a quick break and be back with more here on the Faith Radio Network.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And let me encourage you to check out that website we've been talking about, myfaithradio.com, and you will be nourished, you will grow, you will be challenged, you'll learn more about the Christian faith and applying it to your everyday life. Just some great stuff on there. Every day it's new and there's fresh new material there, both in the podcasts and in the blogs. So do check that out today, myfaithradio.com. We'd also love to hear your comments on what you see on the website. You can find the contact link there and get a hold of us and tell us what you like, what you don't like. We'd love to hear your input. Well, my guest is Dr. Gary Berg. He is the author of A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. Gary is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the Chicago area. Gary, you have this central character. Tell us who's the Roman centurion. He goes to Capernaum, and something very significant happens there. Let's take the biblical narrative and then tell us how you researched the cultural setting and what actually did occur.
Well, the story that we have in Matthew 8 is a fairly simple story, Bill. So we have the centurion. We know he's in Capernaum. The question is, what is he doing in Capernaum? How many soldiers does he have with him? His servant is desperately ill. We don't know what's wrong with the servant. We know that Jesus heals the servant from a distance, and we know that Jesus, by Jewish expectation, is not going to step foot inside of the Roman's house. Now, why wouldn't he not do that? But even that, the centurion understands Jewish law, and he will not invite him into the house. So everything is done from a distance. So there's a lot to explain there. So what I had to do in the story arc that you have to build with a narrative like this is I had to sort of figure out, how do I get this violent, slave-owning, concubine-owning centurion, this tough guy, out of his legion into Capernaum, and he gets administratively removed from his legion. And that's one of the surprises inside of the story. He comes into Capernaum.
I think we lost Gary there. All right. We'll see if we can reestablish contact with our guest, Dr. Gary Berg. Once again, the book is called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion. And we'll take a quick break and be right back. Stick with us.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. Sorry we lost Dr. Berzer for a second, but Gary, we just got about 2 minutes left. Tell us quickly, if you would, what happens to the central character, the Roman centurion, in Capernaum?
So the central character of the centurion, he is in Capernaum. There's a tragedy that happens in Capernaum to him, and it has to do with the Jewish community and some of his Roman enemies. Jesus heals not just the centurion, but someone important inside of his household. But here was the fun part. Actually, this is not in the New Testament, but I decide to bring Jesus into the centurion's household.
Mm.
And the centurion and Jesus have a very private, very interesting conversation about the nature of his life in the empire and the nature of Jesus' ministry inside of Judea. It was fun to write. So there's a really nice conclusion to wrap this thing up. But I insisted with the press, I didn't want to make this a simple, clean little conversion. I mean, this is a man who would not be converted easily. So it's, it's kind of messy at the end, but I expect that's the way it was.
Mm.
When this man meets Jesus, he has a lot to think about.
A lot to lose if he makes this decision to follow this man.
Enormous amount to lose, and yet Jesus will upend his world.
Mm.
And the upending of his world sets him on a course of thinking about everything in his life that he had never planned on. So that's really where I was driving the entire book. I wanted to find out, what would it be like if a real centurion, with all of his toughness, you know, a Russell Crowe centurion.
You've whetted our appetite here, Gary, and I want to encourage all of our listeners to pick up this book. It's called A Week in the Life of a Roman Centurion, the author, Dr. Gary Burst. Gary, thank you so much for your time and for this labor of love.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
We really appreciate you and your scholarship and your just very, very cool work on this book. I'm Bill Meyer. That wraps things up for today. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and thanks for listening to the Faith Radio Network. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, just go to myfaithradio.com and click on the program page for Dr. Bill Meyer Live.